From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. Later, we'll be talking with Carl Racine, the Attorney General of the District of Columbia, and Richard Black, a member of the Virginia State Senate, who just won his seat again. But first, Tom Sherwood, good to see you.
Hello. You know, I won't fall back. I'm not ready for another summer or Indian summer. I won't fall back.
Oh, no, I love the Indian summer. This is the last day of it that we'll be getting. So try to enjoy it. Try not to be a grouch.
I'm going to be grump.
Try not to be grumpy about it. You do have something you're happy about, because despite the fact that you and I both turned them down, WMATA has finally found a general manager that it feels can run the institution, Paul J. Wiedefeld. He's the former head of the Maryland Transit Administration and Baltimore-Washington International Marshall Airport. Earlier in the week, there was the news that the individual who a week ago had been identified as the front runner for the position, the individual who was in negotiations with Metro, Neil Cohen, he decided that he wasn't going to do it. But by Thursday, they came up with Paul Wiedefeld.
Well, Paul Wiedefeld was essentially he was almost tied for first, but he was a second choice. But let me just be clear here. The contract has not been signed.
This is true.
The announcement of Paul accepting the contract has been done, and the negotiations with board chairman apparently are still going to take a week or more, but I would hope that there's no roadblocks come up. He does have a very good reputation, having worked with Thurgood Marshall BWI Airport, certainly Leif Dormsjö, who is the DDOT director, who formerly worked in Maryland State Transportation, has high praise for him. And apparently he is not afraid to speak to the media, which is what one of the issues had been with Neil Cohen, the aerospace guy, who freaked, and I'll use that word because it was quoted to me several times, freaked over the idea that he would be subjected to media coverage.
Tom Sherwood would be all in your business.
Well, you know, Martin DeCarroll here and Adam Tuss at NBC4 and other reporters and me and you and everyone
Tom
else.
Sherwood would be all in your business.
You just cannot have a public, you know, alert to everyone out there who's thinking about public service. If you're in the public service, you're subject to media scrutiny.
Tom Sherwood would be all in your
But business. Let's hope that this works out. He gets in place. He doesn't necessarily need a long learning curve. He's from this area. He's aware of transportation issues with MARC and VRI and Metro. So maybe he'll come in and start acting to get this Metro system back on track.
He's got a lot on his plate, but being from this area, he already knows that. He is probably already familiar with the kind of media scrutiny that he will be getting, so he is likely not to object to that. You know what's really exciting about all of this? Dusty Baker.
Who was third for Metro.
Oh, yes, he should be, because he has a good sense of humor. You would need it with Metro, but that's the new manager Washington Nationals.
I know
Nationals.
You don't particularly. You like baseball.
I like
it's
baseball.
Really
I don't follow
it. Really not
your
heart and soul.
No,
that's right.
Basketball.
But you should have Dusty Baker in. You know, he's a human being. He has a heart. He's well
The last guy wasn't a human being?
Well, he was kind of a grump. He was kind of grumpy. And he would, you know, one of the criticisms of Matt Williams was that he didn't build a camaraderie within the clubhouse with the team.
Dusty Baker
whatever
says
he
love.
Did and some of the strategic mistakes he made, but he did well. He was manager of the year previously, so he wasn't bad. But this team needs someone to manage the personalities of the stars on that team, and so they won't have any more choking incidents in the dugout. Let's hope Dusty Baker does well. I really look forward next year to walking up to the ball game from my little apartment.
And why does this topic show up on the Politics Hour? Because, well, we get to decide. D.C. is thinking of allowing 16-year-olds to vote in this city. They already are allowed to vote in municipal elections in Tacoma Park, Maryland. D.C., however, would go even farther than that and allow them to vote in all elections, including presidential elections here.
Well, I'm struggling with this because I've always thought, you know, people at 18 they are allowed to vote. If you're 17 and you're going to be 18 by the time of the election, you can register to vote. Charles Allen, the Ward 6 council member from the council, proposes that we drop this down to 16. I think it's at Tacoma Park, the People's Republic of Tacoma Park allows it.
Yep.
But, you know, I don't know. Some people would say, well, you know, you have to be 21 to go into a bar and to drink. Why don't we drop that to 18, which is the legal age for adult? I mean, is a 16-year-old an adult? They're not charged as adult in crimes, or they're not allowed to do, like, own properties and things like that without some supervision. Maybe it's a good thing to get them more interested in voting. I'm not against it. I'm just not sure.
I am not sure either. It'll be interesting to hear the arguments. Joining us by phone is Richard Black. He's a member of the Virginia State Senate. He's a Republican representing the 13th District, which includes parts of Loudoun and Prince William counties. Senator Black, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Kojo, it's good to hear from you again, and Tom, look forward to talking with you.
Congratulations on your victory. What do you think about 16-year-olds voting?
Oh, my goodness. You know, we've got to get real about this. We really do not need children selecting our candidates. We have enough trouble with adults selecting our candidates. So, no, I think that's way, you know, way over the top.
Well, Tuesday was a good day for Republicans in Virginia. Democrats had hoped to shift the state Senate their way, but they came up short, including your win in the 13th District. With control of the Senate in the balance, yours was a closely watched race, Senator Black. Both you and your opponent, Jill McCabe, raised unprecedented sums of money, and though McCabe outspent you, she failed ultimately to unseat you. What would you say were the deciding factors in the race?
Well, you know, it was a very interesting race. My opponent outspent us 2-1, roughly put about as much money into this race as a congressional race. She spent about $900,000 on negative TV ads attacking me. And I think her entire campaign was built around social issues, you know, particularly abortion. The one thing that really stood out was the abortion, and she had Planned Parenthood put $250,000 in. Emily's List was out. It's the first time Emily's List had ever gotten involved in a statewide race in their 30-year history, and they decided they needed to go after me. But anyway, we do very hard work. You know, next week alone, I have 23 events and meetings to attend. I'm not quite sure. It's a little mind-boggling, but...
You should fire your scheduler.
Well, I know. You know, we laughingly call this a part-time job, and it is anything but. You know, it might have been back in the days of the horse and buggy, but today it's a very intense job.
If you have questions or comments for Senator Richard Black, call us at 800-433-8850. Send email to kojo@wamu.org or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream there, and ask a question or make a comment.
Senator, let's talk about the broad picture. I know you're glad that you won your race, but it looks like it was a draw. The Republicans retained control of the Senate, which was a big victory for them because that was the number one goal of the Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe, and the Democrats in the state, and as you said, the outside monies that came pouring in. But you fought to a draw on that. In the Republican House, the 100-member House, Republicans lost one vote, dropping them down to, I think, 66 members, which means you don't have a veto-proof majority. What does the overall picture for Virginia look like political? This is the politics hour. What does it look like now going into the presidential race next year? Do you have a candidate for president for Virginia next year?
Well, you know, I have not quite settled on one, but I'm getting close. I think it puts the Republican Party in a very powerful position. I think if you look at things nationally, Virginia was probably the number one target for the Democrat National Committee. They wanted to break what they would consider a logjam here, where we control the Senate, we control the House. And they just threw everything that they could into it. We had Gabby Gifford's group. We had Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York. We had Planned Parenthood, Emily's List. Philip Munger, one of the one percenters out of New York. A lot of New York money. For some reason, they love to try to play games with Virginia politics. But what their objective was to sort of pave the way for Hillary Clinton in Virginia in the presidential election. And I think everybody would agree to that. And they failed. They fell short on it. We continue to hold the vast majority of seats. In fact, you know, it was kind of interesting that listening to the national overview, the Republicans now hold 68 of 98 legislative chambers, which is 2/3 of all of the legislative chambers in the country. I think we're in pretty good shape. We picked up the Kentucky governorship for the first time in 40 years. Just amazing. And I have to believe that has something to do with the war on coal and people just getting fed up. And, you know, Kentucky, their Democratic traditions go back to, you know, sort of mom and dad voted Democrat and they came through the Depression and all this. And it finally broke.
Go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to point out the turnout in Virginia was, I think, was 26.5%, abysmally low, kind of low. So, as you know, in a presidential year, the turnout changes. People are more enthusiastic about voting in presidential years. But I thought it was striking that with all the money, with all the television ads and all the stuff that happened, the Democrats won the vacant Democrat seats. The Republicans won the vacant Republican seats. And you started out you're at the end of the year where you started at the beginning. You're tied in the Senate. What does that mean for the people of Virginia in terms of this legislature getting anything done when it convenes in January?
Well, I think a couple of things. You know, the governor, you know, his signature issue was Medicaid expansion so that he could extend Obamacare to Virginia. And we blocked him. In fact, I blocked him with a budget amendment. So that really is off the table at this point. I think everybody's locked in. I don't think we're going to see a shift. I think he had hopes that on behalf of Mayor Bloomberg, he could do some things with guns.
Well, let me ask you about that for a second, because some analysts have suggested that the gun control issue motivated a lot of Republicans in this off-year election because they opposed gun restrictions. They were motivated to get out to the polls, especially because of the money that poured in from that group backed by former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Do you think that was a factor?
I do think that was a factor. Now, it cut a little bit both ways, because I ran into people at the polls who said, you know, I am concerned about the gun issue, and, you know, it had been really hyped up. So my guess is that in some areas it probably had a net positive, but I don't think statewide it was a good strategy. I think it was a very bad strategy. You don't want to mess with the gun people. It's a very powerful lobby, and it's a grassroots lobby, and it has a lot of strength.
It looks like, though, in Northern Virginia, particularly Loudoun County, Prince William, where you represent, that the trend lines, the demographic trend lines for Hispanics and younger people, more moderate to liberal people moving into Northern Virginia, is that the trend line for the Republican Party in Northern Virginia is not that good, despite the victories that you enjoyed Tuesday.
Well, I don't know. You sort of have to put that in the context of the money. You know, money does have an impact on politics, and Planned Parenthood and NARAL, all the abortion groups set up camp. Now, we had a much higher turnout in Northern Virginia. I'm not sure what it was, 32% or something like that. And they, you know, they did a very intensive knock and drag campaign, And so they were able to, you know, they were able to bump their numbers, but it didn't get them there. And, you know, the question is, you know, can you spend congressional funds, you know, funds in that amount for every Senate seat in the future? It's going to be tough for them to pull this off again.
What do you think about the so-called Nova-Rover split, Northern Virginia, rest of Virginia, that Northern Virginia looks very different from the rest of Virginia, but also that the line is moving farther south as demographics change?
Well, yeah, you know, Republicans tend to do well in suburban areas. When people have a vested interest in their own homes and that type of thing, they tend to be more regular voters. They're more concerned about property taxes, things like that. And I think, you know, people who live in apartments and rely a great deal on government services and government money, I think, you know, that tends to favor the Democrats somewhat. There always are going to be shifts, but I just think, considering the vast amount of money that was spent, I know that there were Democrats who had very high hopes that they were going to pick up, you know, two or three seats in the Senate. And in fact, we had more Senate seats to defend than they had. And the fact that we held every one, I think, speaks well and you know, kind of sets us up for the presidential election campaign.
Well, I would say a reporter, Dave Ress, who works for the Daily Press down in the Norfolk Newport News area, said that it looks like the only way you can get a change in the state Senate is if somebody retires.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know,
no incumbent in a year nationally when people are saying, oh, it's the year of the outsider. You see the Republican Party and what's happening there, and the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, that it's the year of the outsider. People are fed up. Well, in fact, every incumbent won, and every vacant seat that had been Republican or Democratic was filled by the person of the same party. It's like stalemate.
You know, at least in the Senate, one of the interesting things is that the Senate lines were drawn by the Democrats. There was kind of an agreement. The Republicans would do the House lines, the Democrats would do the Senate lines, and the governor would do the congressional lines. And so to some extent, I guess the Democrats are victims of their own success on drawing the Senate lines. But anyway, we've got that. I will tell you, one of my favorite comments was made by a radio announcer downstate, John Fredericks, and he had made some predictions. He said, never bet against an incumbent who left his blood on a rice field in Vietnam fighting against communist aggression. So I really appreciated that. I thought that was kind of a neat comment. But it was quite a battle, and I just think, you know, I think that, you know, if I were advising the Democrats, I would say, you know what, you really have got to moderate. You know, when you're doing the men and women's locker rooms and stuff like that, you're kind of pushing the envelope a little bit.
Wouldn't they say the same thing to you? I think you are pretty right conservative on every issue that I could read about. Wouldn't they say the same thing to you? Can't we, you know, moderate each side? Would you be willing to moderate
meet
your
somewhere
views
in the middle?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing that there were a lot of claims. One of the things they said, well, I was going to take away their birth control. Birth control was settled by the Supreme Court in 65. There's never been a bill introduced in any legislature about it. They accused me of being for spousal rape, and I was the only one in the General Assembly who'd ever prosecuted a spousal rape. And I was the chief of the criminal law division for the Army and the Pentagon and really had a tremendous crackdown on sexual assault against women and children. And I think when truth is told, you know, I've been pretty mainstream. And
well, they would say that you supported the tightening of controls on clinics that had to meet hospital standards in order to have abortions, which Terry McAuliffe has reversed.
Absolutely, and I guess I would come back and say, you know, I remember when they were pushing for abortion, they said, well, we're going to do away with the coat hanger abortions, and I don't understand, you know, them resisting, you know, sanitary and health and safety regulations. So okay. I mean, you know, we've got a reasonable debate on that issue, I think.
Let's try one more. I know that you oppose same-sex marriage. I know you did not like the Supreme Court ruling on that. But now same-sex marriage is the law of the land. How is that playing out in Virginia? Is that now over and you're going to move forward on other issues? How does that stand?
I don't know. You know, the problem we've got is the people are supposed to be sovereign in this country, and it's really more of a myth because the Supreme Court issues laws. It doesn't just interpret the law, but it creates law. It's the highest legislative body in the land. Three fifths of all of the states had gone through this enormously cumbersome process to change their constitutions to say marriage is one man and one woman. And then the word came down from wherever it comes down to the Supreme Court saying, hey, guys, we're sick of this. If we don't stop it, we're going to have 50 states that are all going to put this in their constitution.
How is that different from...
Supreme Court just wiped it out and said, you know what, we don't care what the people say. We are the rulers, and nobody can overrule us.
How does that differ from Supreme Court ruling on Brown versus Board of Education and desegregation of schools and any other number of issues?
Well, you know, there is a parallel between what we have and what they have in Iran. In Iran, the people elect their parliament, they elect their president, but they have ayatollahs who have the final decision. They can issue decrees, they can cancel legislation, and as a consequence, the people really have no power.
Are you comparing the Supreme Court to the ayatollahs?
Yes.
Okay.
Because frankly, they create laws.
Well, I have to pursue.
There's nobody who can tell me that there is a scintilla of law or constitutional support for saying that you can redefine marriage. That's it. You know, the Supreme Court doesn't have the authority to pass laws, but they're doing it. And unfortunately, we don't have checks and balances. And in that respect, we're very much like the ayatollahs. The people have no voice. They don't have any control. I would like to see an amendment where the Supreme Court stood, the justices would stand for election on staggered 6-year terms so that every 2 years, three justices have to stand for election. And then they can explain to the people, okay, the reason that I don't know the difference between men and women is because of this provision of the Constitution or whatever. I think people would probably defer to them as long as they can actually show some law.
But you're also suggesting that the final interpretation of the Constitution is something that should be put to a vote?
Well, I think the question is, do we believe that the people are sovereign? That was the original premise of the United States of America, is that the people are sovereign. The people are not governed by some group of elitists who can simply wipe away whatever they do. I mean,
we're running out of time very quickly, and Tom Sherwood has another question.
I apologize. One quick question. You served in the Marines. You served in the Army. You fought in Vietnam. You're a veteran, and thank you for your service. What do you think about the money the National Guard has been spending to put on essentially fake programmed at sports arenas around the country to honor the veterans and make it sound like it was something done by the sports entities themselves, but in fact was paid for by the National Guard.
You know, now I don't blame the National Guard so much, but I blame the greedy people who run these sports teams. They ought to have the patriotism to do this on their own. Those guys are mega billionaires. They don't need to suck money out of the public trough just to show the flag and the national anthem. I think it's a disgrace, but the disgrace is not the National Guard. The disgrace is these wealthy owners of these public teams who don't have the patriotism to say, you know what, I want our flag out there. I want our national anthem. I want to show a little patriotism. There's just too much greed. And I blame it on those guys.
Thank you very much.
Richard Black is a member of the Virginia State Senate. He's a Republican representing the 13th District, which includes parts of Loudoun and Prince William counties. Senator Black, thank you for joining us. Once again, congratulations.
Great talking to you, Kojo, and you also, Tom.
Best wishes in January.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with Current Newspapers. Joining us in studio now is Carl Racine. He is the Attorney General for the District of Columbia. Carl Racine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kojo. Good to see you, Tom.
Tom, we have a new U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, and he says the investigation into the 2010 campaign of former Mayor Vincent Gray is one of his top priorities, that he will be making a decision on whether to charge the former mayor as expeditiously as possible. Gray has been under investigation for the past 4.5 years.
Yes, and most of the sources that we've talked to and the Post has talked to and others who've reported on this story have said that they think this could be done by December. I know that the U.S. Attorney's Office has postponed several status cases for the people who already pled guilty, Jeffrey Thompson, a few others, Vernon Hawkins, to December the 16th, which is the week before Christmas. So I'm thinking maybe the cards are where they're supposed to be lined up, that this we could have a decision from Channing Phillips. He's just sitting down in the seat where he's the acting U.S. attorney.
And it would appear that one of the reasons he got that seat was dissatisfaction over his rival, Vinnie Cohen Jr., over not bringing this case to some kind of resolution.
Well, there was an anger about that, but for Channing Phillips, anyone who knows Channing will know he's doing exactly what you would expect him to do. He's doing a thorough run-through on this. What do we have? What do we know? What do we think we know? What do we not know? And should we go forward? So that's what he's doing, and I think we will get a resolution for this. The question is, will they announce a resolution, or will they just charge the other people in the court, give them their sentences, and then move on? We don't know.
Let's see if the Attorney General knows, because, Mr. Attorney General, you issued a statement indicating you were in the process of becoming fully briefed on this investigation. Bring us up to date.
Well, I'm not sure what you're referring to
me
there,
either.
Kojo.
Me either.
But what I can tell you is that I certainly have known Channing Phillips.
Oh, no, that was the U.S. attorney who issued that statement. I'm sorry.
Okay. Not a problem.
I thought we had made major news here.
That's right.
I hope so, too.
Well, let me say this, though. First, Channing Phillips is a longtime public servant who has an exceptional reputation, and I take him at his word. He is going to conduct a thorough review, as he indicated, of all of the evidence. And like Tom, I believe he's going to make a decision, go forward or not go forward, in a short period of time.
Well, I wanted to question you about an opinion that was floated in an op-ed piece in the Washington Post a week or so ago that indicated that the attorney for Jeffrey Thompson really made a very good play by having his client make that plea just some short time before the election, because of the timing of it. Mr. Thompson was promised a fairly lenient sentence. It would appear he won't serve at any point more than 6 months in jail. From a strategic point of view, what do you think about that?
Well, from a strategic point of view, you know, it certainly does appear that Mr. Thompson was certainly able to take advantage of the timing of the election in a way that that benefited him. At the end of the day, I must say that Vincent Cohen and Ron Machen, although they're being severely criticized for their work, the reality is that no one knows what they know. And to that extent, I think it's a good thing that Channing now will have a chance to know what they knew and we'll have an opportunity to make a decisive decision.
If you have questions or comments for Carl Racine, you can call us at 800-433-8850. He's the Attorney General for the District of Columbia. You can also go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream, ask a question or make a comment there, or send it to us by email at kojo@wamu.org.
I want to move on to some contemporary issues, but had Ron Machen, then the U.S. Attorney, not taken action with the client willing to plead guilty and waiting until after the election, that is being driven by the election calendar, he would have been severely criticized by that. And he had said on this program and other programs that he gets the evidence, he weighs the evidence, his staff does, the attorney, assistant U.S. attorneys, and then they make a decision. And that he and Vinnie Cohen and now Channing Phillips don't play by the media politics clock that we all play by.
Well, I think that's exactly right, Tom. And prosecutors are often criticized in high-profile cases for the timing of their work. And they just have to be big boys and big girls and take it. And that's certainly what Ron and Vincent Cohen have done. At the end of the day, and I'm happy that it looks like a decision is coming, Channing is going to base his finding on evidence. And I think the city needs to move forward from this investigation.
Let's talk real politics here on the Politics Hour. Fresh Pack. I know you know about it because you live in the city. You keep up on these things.
Fresh Pack, for those of our listeners who may not know about it.
Well, I was going to give a sentence. This is the independent, supposedly, legally independent, political action committee set up by Mayor Muriel Bowser's intimate supporters. And she has done fundraising, as she can do this year under the law, to raise $1 million, Fresh Pack, to battle, to support her views and her positions and maybe oppose people like you who might oppose her. I've been told by people very close to the mayor that one of the reasons she thinks this pack is a good idea is because she's concerned about you and Ward 5 Councilmember Kenyon McDuffie possibly running against her in 3 years. A year of her term is already almost up. So that you are one of the reasons for Fresh Pack. What do you think about that?
Well, regarding Fresh Pack, my opinion is informed, and I certainly have my views.
I'm waiting to hear them.
My opinion is also informed by the views of the residents of the District of Columbia. And I can tell you that my office has been deluged with phone calls, emails, letters, and when we go out in the community and talk about crime and other issues, all the time, what's top of people's mind is Fresh Pack. And what they're concerned about is the return of flagrant pay-to-play politics in the District of Columbia. And citizens in the District of Columbia don't want that. They want that day to have passed, and they really want pay-to-play politics to be over. And so what our office is doing is we're responding to the public's concerns, and we are actively working on appropriate, strong campaign finance legislation that would seek to eliminate pay-to-play.
You laid out a few major priorities in your campaign at the start of your term. One big one was honest government. In terms of Fresh Pack, what are you doing to move forward in terms of accountability and, for this one, transparency for public officials and in the procurement process?
Well, that's exactly what we set forth in the campaign, and it certainly was well received. Here, I think what we've got to do is go back to proposed legislation, quite ironically, that was proposed by Vincent Gray. Legislation that was hard-hitting, that was specific and direct, that would ban contractors who are seeking to do business with the District of Columbia or who are actually doing business with the District of Columbia from contributing to campaigns.
Look, all right, I want to bring up something that Patrick Madden, a reporter here, and I have been working on in terms of Fresh Pack. He pressed Exelon, and we're going to get into the Exelon-Pepco merger. He has pressed Exelon to say publicly to him whether or not it has been asked to contribute to Fresh Pack. Exelon declined to say whether they had even been approached or asked. They have not given the money at this point because at least it has not shown up in any current reporting file. On the
Fresh Pack
side,
declined to say whether they asked, and Exelon declined to say whether they were asked.
Well, I'm sorry, I got to talk faster because Kojo's jumping on me. I asked Pepco, I told Pepco, I said, I have been told that each of you, Exelon and Pepco, have been asked to give $20,000 to Freshpack, and that these asks came within the period of time the Pepco-Exelon merger is before the mayor and her reaching a compromise. I have been this week, have been told by people who are involved that the monies asked were, could have totaled $100,000. And remember, the Freshpack has said it wants to raise $1 million, and that Exelon and Pepco have both declined in writing to say whether they were even asked. Shouldn't the people of the city know whether these two major firms have been asked to give money to that Freshpack before the merger goes through?
Well, Tom, I can certainly understand that question, and I do think the public has a right to understand whether such a request was made. And this is what causes the problem with pay-to-play politics. The public can't be confident that a deal is received on the merits, where you have contractors who are being requested, solicited, or in fact giving money when they have an issue before the government.
Great. I've asked, as a reporter, I've said, I'd just like to know if you were asked. I didn't say how you were asked, what was the ask. I just said, were you asked? And I got written, no, we're not going to talk about it. I just think it's for the Public Service Commission ought to know if there's a side game going on other than the legal discussion and analysis of the proposed settlement that Mayor Bowser has done to get Pepco and Exelon to merge.
I understand, and I think those are valid concerns. Again, this is what the problem is when you have loose campaign finance laws that allow for questions like the one you're asking, that is a fair question, to create an appearance of impropriety. We should reduce even the appearance of impropriety.
Gun control in the district. Last month, you asked a federal appeals court to reconsider its decision on the city's gun registration laws. And Eric in Washington, D.C. has a question about that. Eric, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Cody, as always, thank you so much for giving me the chance to join you in your weekly conversation. This time you have my boss. Called is actually I work in the OAG's office, but that's not the reason I was calling. I was obviously concerned that I think the district, again, might lose the case before the Supreme Court, and I wanted to see what Carl makes of that. And a comment quickly, Carl. Do you suppose that you could come up with some kind, our office cannot come up with some kind of a regulation that helps elderly people who get basically lose their money every week when they get on these buses going to the gambling places outside our jurisdiction. You know where I'm talking about. I mean, the man loses his entire Social Security check. And I have been on those buses with some of those people, and I can tell you there's a great deal of ignorance on the risk of gambling. And I wish we could come
up with something. You're conflating two different issues here. Let's try to deal with one at a time. And no, Eric, you're not getting that raise that you wanted, but he's Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you for saving our budget, Kojo. Eric, first, on the issue of the gun regulations, we have, in fact, filed a motion for reconsideration and rehearing en banc before the entire D.C. Circuit in regards to 10 regulations that the D.C. Council passed related to long guns. Six of those regulations were upheld by the D.C. Circuit, but four were struck down. We believe that the council exercised excellent judgment, passed law based on research and data that suggested that registrations and other restrictions would enhance public safety, and that's why we're defending the legislation. It could very well be that that case, as well as other cases that we're defending the city in related to gun control, will make it back up to the Supreme Court. And I'm proud to say that we have excellent litigators in our Solicitor General's office who are prepared to deliver a victory.
800-433-8850 is the number. More broadly, you think the fight over D.C.'s concealed carry law could end up going to the Supreme Court?
Kojo, there are a couple of cases percolating in other circuits, and certainly the D.C. case that we have is one of those cases. And so there is a 50% chance that once again, just as we were before the Supreme Court in Heller, a carry and concealed case stemming from the D.C. could be right back up there.
Wow. Another issue, Mayor Bowser is going to China Saturday with a group of about 30 people. The CFO, Jeffrey DeWitt's going with her. War II council member Jack Evans is going, the only council member. I actually have the agenda here, which I was showing you in the documents. Nothing's on the agenda about one of the biggest issues that you've taken on in the city as Attorney General, and that's synthetic drugs. The New York Times and the White House has called China the pipeline of synthetic drugs to this country and to Mexico. Mark Seagraves is doing a story today for News 4 about should the mayor on this economic trip to bring more investment to the city bring up the issue of what synthetic drugs coming from China are doing to this city and to this nation.
Well, I think
it's
the mayor
not on the agenda.
Sure, I think the mayor and the team should certainly raise issues that impact the public safety of the District of Columbia. And that is not at all to accuse the Chinese government of complicity in this. But nonetheless, the facts do reveal, and this is from DEA and FBI, that a lot of the synthetic drugs are making their way to the United States from China. We should sign some sort of memorandum of understanding or agreement whereby the Chinese government agrees to do all that it can to identify those folks who are manufacturing the drugs that are having a serious consequence on the lives of district citizens.
The New York Times reported that there are 150 or more websites from China at which you can order these synthetic drugs.
They're readily available, they're cheap, and they're unpredictable. Many, many people suffer from extraordinary violent reactions. I believe, Kojo, that the medical examiner is about to report that there were, in fact, three deaths that resulted from an overdose of chemical drugs. Those will be the first deaths from overdose of chemical cannabinoids.
Got to say that Tisha Thompson at NBC4 has been doing a series on the issue, and yesterday she reported the DC Fire and EMS had a record number of transports for September, taxing an already taxed EMS system, and a lot of that had to do with synthetic marijuana. One of the first issues your office tackled was reviewing the implications of real marijuana legalization measures the D.C. voters approved last year. Congress attempted to overturn it. Where does that stand?
Well, as you know, marijuana is legal to possess and use in the private home in the District of Columbia. There's also allowance for growing a small amount of marijuana in the city. Unfortunately, the congressional rider that precludes the District of Columbia from responsibly regulating the purchase and sale of marijuana is still in effect. I think that's incredibly unfortunate. I will note that there are scientific studies out there that reveal in states where marijuana is legal, the incidence of heroin abuse and abuse of other drugs like synthetic cannabinoids is much lower than what we're experiencing here in the District of Columbia.
We're experiencing an increase in heroin use in the district, too.
We are. The D.C.'s numbers with respect to heroin abuse are not as dramatically high as they are in other states like Maryland, Massachusetts, Ohio, and others. But there was a pretty dramatic increase of about 20% in the last month. And so I don't think we can be complacent here in the District of Columbia in regards to heroin.
What do you think accounts for the fact that it's happening in suburbs? Is it because the suburbs are more urban? Or is it more, in fact, let's just say it, more white people are having heroin problems than in the past? And now suddenly I've heard some politicians say, oh, well, we've got to treat this as a health care issue, not a crime issue, and lock up people who are using drugs, which is a little bit different than when it was seen as an African-American problem.
In the inner
but
city.
What is the accounting for why heroin is sudden? Is it because it's cheap? It's just available?
Sure. So a big question that you asked, and I should tell you that the Office of Attorney General, Public Safety Division, we've launched an emerging drugs task force to study all drugs that where residents are abusing and are involved in criminal activity. With respect to heroin, there's clear demographic data that indeed suggests that non-Hispanic whites are more inclined to be heroin addicts. And so use in rural areas where the demographics are mostly white, you've seen a greater incidence of heroin abuse. And I would have to rely on that data to suggest that that probably is the reason why the why there is a less high incidence of heroin use in the District of Columbia.
On to Jerome in Adelphi, Maryland. Jerome, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. Hi, Coach Joe. Hi, Mr. Attorney General. Mr. Racine, the Inspector General in the district did a report last month on the Child Support Agency, and they were actually had investigators in our office yesterday, and I was wondering, are you doing follow-up on that report, and do you have any plans you could announce on what you would do in to follow up on the IG's recommendations?
What are the IG's recommendations in brief? Caller?
I don't think I could summarize them, but I think Mr. Racine's very familiar with them.
Carl Racine?
Sure. Here's the situation. It's not at all unusual for there to be complaints from time to time about inefficiency, waste, and other potential problems. When those complaints are made, I can tell you what our office does. We call the relevant authority. And so I'm not sure whether this one was OAG initiated, but the IG, Mr. Lucas, does a great job of coming in. And of course, we cooperate fully. He'll produce a report. He'll make recommendations. And to the extent that we agree with the recommendations, we'll implement those.
Your office prosecutes juveniles. Crime is a big topic in the districts right now. But one of your priorities in your campaign was around juvenile justice and making sure that services reach kids who are at risk. Is there some tension between trying to do that and keeping the community safe? You said we're going to spend a lot of time trying to refocus our energies in the area of restorative justice, getting kids out of the system.
There is no inconsistency at all. Rehabilitating kids, making the smart decisions as to which kids you're going to prosecute and bring into the system and which kids you're going to instead divert out of the system where they can get wraparound services in the community, all goes to keeping the community safe. Let me give you a couple facts, Kojo and Tom. Since we took office, we have, in fact, diverted more kids than in prior years by a factor of five. I can also tell you, and I look at this every day, 87% of those young people who we have diverted from entry into the criminal justice system have not been rearrested. There are actually excellent programs in the District of Columbia that can take kids who are involved in nonviolent activities, just making bad decisions, getting close to the line, and give them the discipline, the support, oftentimes mental health and substance abuse help that they need, and get them making good decisions.
On the nature of 16-year-olds and younger people, what do you think about Charles Allen, the Ward 6 council member, proposing that 16-year-olds be allowed to vote?
Well, I respect Charles Allen a lot.
Uh-oh.
There's a book coming here.
It sounds like you know that Charles has a pool of 16-year-olds who also like him a lot. No, I've not really studied the issue. I know Tacoma Park allows that. I'd have to take a look at it, to be honest. We do know that young people are precocious and smart. We also know that young people oftentimes need more years to be mature and to make sound adult judgments.
You're the district's first independently elected attorney general. Let's talk about how that independence is working or how it might have been compromised. The position used to be mayor appointed, council approved. You've already had some skirmishes with Mayor Bowser, including a move on the part of the mayor to shift some authority from your office to hers. What's the relationship between, like now, between your office and the mayor's?
Sure.
Can I just change the question just a little bit?
No. Go ahead.
In the spring, in the winter and spring, when the mayor first took over, her office tried to gut your office. How's it going now?
That's what I was referring to.
That's what polite Kojo was saying.
Yes.
Well, indeed, you cite back to the initial months of our office, and sure enough, the executive office of the mayor proposed really dramatic legislation that seriously would have gutted the independence of the office.
She wanted the authority to task her staff attorneys to provide legal reviews of contracts, city laws, and other matters.
Right. She wanted to approve her own contracts.
Right, which is what your office does.
That's correct. And the other piece of that is that the proposed legislation also sought to make our office subordinate again to the mayor's office and sought to really eliminate the public interest charter and mandate that our office has. To make a long story short, that legislation failed. The Office of Attorney General is independent and strong. In fact, yesterday I had the opportunity to be with Attorney General Holder in the U.S. District Court of D.C., where both he and I spoke, and I gave a State of the OAG speech in which I emphasized that while we always seek to collaborate with the mayor's office and do on a regular basis, we will not hesitate to be independent, and we've exhibited such. You might recall just 2 weeks ago, in regards to the mayor's crime bill, the Office of Attorney General, in somewhat of an unprecedented move, testified against aspects of the mayor's crime bill.
The warrantless,
suspicionless searches that would have required a federal agency to do that which they were not trained to do.
We only have about a minute left. One of your priorities was to enhance the office's work in consumer protection. Biggest test so far, Exelon-Pepco merger. You opposed the original proposal, which was rejected by the Public Service Commission. What is your position now that the revisions have been negotiated by Mayor Bowser?
Well, there's an untold story there, and this is where we act, again, collaboratively. Here's the deal. The deal is that the Office of Attorney General thought that the initial proposal that Exelon made was woefully short.
What about the next one? We only got 20 seconds.
Here it is. We negotiated for 10 days with my chief deputy, Natalie Ludaway, who you know well. And I can tell you that Natalie Ludaway and the Office of People's Counsel went over every line of that agreement. And the reason why we have a substantial deal on the table is because OAG and EOM collaborated on negotiations.
Yeah, I know Natalie Ludaway.
We'll find
she pushes
out fresh
real hard. Carl Racine is the Attorney General for the District of Columbia. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Tom Sherwood, always a pleasure.
Good weekend.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.